Welcome to Worlds Apart. There is an old Latin dictum, civis pacem, parabellum. If you want peace, prepare for war, which may be taken as a call to violence in some humanist circles, but within it is also a plea for a grounded, responsible handling of reality. Can this study of war and its dynamics enable peace? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Jan Åberg, director of the people-funded Transnational Foundation for Peace and Future Research. Mr. Åberg, it's great to talk to you again. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Now, Mr. Åberg, we live in a very interesting era when almost everybody has an opinion, and it's usually a very passionate one, about the issues of war and peace. And it's usually that war is beyond comprehension. That is, it does not need to be comprehended. It only needs to be condemned. It does not need to be studied. It does not need to be understood for all the underlying reasons. And I wonder if this very passionately ethical, but perhaps not very labored stance is directly responsible for the preponderance of conflicts in the world today.
I think we should make a distinction between violence and war on the one hand and conflicts on the other. Media and people love to talk about, or condemn, as you say, warfare, or they love to do warfare or sell weapons to war zones, etc. What we do in the peace research business is to look at the underlying conflicts, because that's where the key to solutions are lying. There's never a solution to a conflict on the in the battlefield. That has its own dynamics, and at some point, you know, the parties will be exhausted or one will win or whatever. But what we look at is, like a doctor, a diagnosis, what's underlying the violence? Why do we have a war here or there? And what are what is the issue that stands between the parties? And that's a fundamentally important question, because most people look at the war and then they take a stand, who is right, who is wrong. That's a completely irrelevant thing to do. If you're a professional, you ask, what is the problem that stands between the parties? What is it they can't solve? Because violence comes when you can't handle your conflicts.
You're treating violence as essentially as a product, as a consequence of the pre-existing disagreements. But I think more and more we are seeing violence or conflict being employed as simply a means to achieving certain policies, not as the ultimate result of the countries or sides exhausting all the possible methods, but simply as the first option of achieving what you want. Don't you think that perhaps the paradigm of how nation states are using the war has changed in recent years?
Oh, absolutely, particularly in the last few years when the West is going down, relatively speaking. I'm getting more and more desperate and not able to use diplomatic power, economic power, cultural power, and all that the way it did, let's say, in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. What you have left now, the only thing the West and the United States is good at is warfare, or better at than anybody else. However, that said, they have lost all the wars since Vietnam, morally and in terms of international law and everything. But I think also what you see is a parasite-like activity of what I call MIMAC, the military industrial media academic complex, MIMAC, where you have small elites who have never been elected to do anything, who operate behind the screens, behind the politicians, behind the parliaments, and promote these images of enemies which legitimate, you know, more money for the military. So you're right, whereas international law and the UN Charter clearly says that violence should be the last resort, and Article 1 says that peace shall be established by peaceful means. My God, that's what all countries have written, signed under on the UN Charter. They're totally violating it. Everyone is violating that today, and that's because the global system is in a huge transformation and change.
Now, speaking about the international system, I checked some figures as I was preparing for this conversation, and according to the United Nations, at the end of 2022, for the first time in recorded history, the number of people forcibly displaced reached 108 million, with over 35 million refugees. And clearly, it's not just the Ukrainian conflict. We have an unprecedented number of people suffering all around the world. You singled out a couple of factors that I think contributes to that, but more generally, what do you think is driving this, what's behind this ballooming number of both refugees and internally displaced people, despite the fact that, you know, as you said, the West seems to have lost many wars, but it keeps pressing the same strategy forward?
You could see it this way, that the world's priorities have been totally perverse for decades. It's just getting worse. The resources available for, let's say, for peace, for development, for human rights, for what you and I would call good and important objects or goals to achieve, including the UN Sustainable Goal Program, etc., are way smaller than what the world's countries spend on the military. If you take the United Nations, I think it has something like $10 billion for whatever it does, while you have more than $2,000 billion wasted on military. If you could, and I could say, well, that is a valuable investment because the world is moving towards peace and we are living in with mutual understanding thanks to the armament. If that was true, I would not say that it's a perverse thing, but the perverse thing is the world has never spent as much on the military and been as insecure as it is now. And it's not Ukraine, it's all other places. Ukraine is, don't misunderstand me, every single suffering person in Ukraine, innocent person, it touches my heart. But it's a small conflict in that respect compared with what the United States and NATO countries have done since 9/11, for instance. We're talking about millions of people being killed. And that is something we have to talk about. Why do we accept as citizens that those priorities that each of our governments are spending unlimited sums, it seems, on the military that has never proved to make peace or make the whole world system better because of realpolitik and all these things?
Mr. Oberg, I very passionately agree with you and disagree with you at the same time because I don't like this generalization. I think there are a number of countries, for example, even you know, old rivals like Saudi Arabia and Iran that are moving away from this hackneyed rivalry and that putting peace and development ahead of, you know, ideological or religious disagreements. You know, there are other countries like, let's say, Armenia and Turkey that are also exploring ways of doing it diplomatically, settling their disagreements diplomatically. And I would argue that Russia, for a number of years, has tried to negotiate its very existential disagreements with both NATO and Ukraine in good faith. It has done that before the active phase of this conflict. And since that, there were several rounds of negotiations. And yet, we have this same dynamic here. It's as if every new war that the West launches is like it happens without any previous context. It's as if people have forgotten about Libya, they've forgotten about Syria, they've forgotten about Vietnam, Iraq, etc. What explains, in your view, this collective amnesia on the part of the Western public? Because we are aware of all the conflicts that have been fought around the world, and we are aware of what is, you know, of the suffering that my country is causing to people in Ukraine. I'm ready to accept that fully, and I have relatives in Ukraine. But it seems that when it comes to the West, it always has like some sort of a blank slate when it comes to every new conflict.
I think it's very much to do with the fact that, you know, the West is kind of a leader. I mean, if you're number one in a system, which I think the United States still think that it is, then you teach, you don't learn. This arrogance of power becomes worse and worse over time. That's one thing. The other thing, of course, is, and maybe that's controversial to say, but for me, who's been in this type of academic research on peace and conflict issues, and I worked in war zones most of my professional life, I must say, I don't think it's possible anymore to understand Western security and defense policy with rational analytical theories, concepts. It's now moved into the realm of the irrational, emotionalist, populist thinking. I've been through everything NATO says on its homepage. There's no more analysis there. There is postulates about your country, about China being the new big threat. And it boils down to it's a threat because it's different from us. So you invent who is a threat to you, because if you don't have a threat psychologically, you cannot argue that taxpayers should keep on throwing money into the militarist activities such as warfare, such as new weapon systems, such as new nuclear weapons and all that. And that military, industrial, media, academic complex exists in lots of countries, your country too, China too, Iran and Saudi Arabia that you mentioned. Everybody who has those driving forces outside the control of democratic decision making. That's exactly what Eisenhower said. We have a military industrial complex that is beyond democratic control and it's dangerous. It will eat up the American society and its resources and creativity.
This is a very interesting question. Let's pause for a moment. We have to take a short break, but we will return to that after a few seconds. Stay tuned.
Настоящую гибридную войну, которая обрела уже беспрецедентный характер.
Вся история противостояния в Донбассе – это история, то есть это этап гибридной войны. Вся.
Конфликт между Соединенными Штатами и Россией, когда Киев должен быть инструментом для уничтожения России.
We are gambling with the future of all mankind, and we're risking it for nothing.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Jan Åberg, Director of the People-Funded Transnational Foundation for Peace and Future Research. Mr. Åberg, before the break, you mentioned this issue of the arrogance of power, and I don't remember who said it, but one of the analysts I respect a lot, he said that the United States is indeed exceptional in being able to strike with impunity anywhere around the world and having unparalleled security advantage, because no other country, it used to be at least like that, no other country could strike it directly. But as you mentioned, the military costs are rising up, and they're rising up not only in the United States, but I think what distinguishes other societies from America is that other societies are actually investing into themselves. Look at China, look at Russia, look even at Iran, at Saudi Arabia. They're actually putting resources into building material life, public sector for their people. But I think the United States, all the advantages in terms of lifestyle it had, it is losing it quickly. When do you think this dynamic of the arrogance of power that is totally neglecting its own people while killing people overseas, when do you think it will catch up with the people within the West collectively?
Oh, there's no doubt in my mind that you don't have to be a moral philosopher to know that the more power you have, the more careful and humble you should be. Now, if you don't have that moral, spiritual, whatever dimension to the fact that you have military or economic or political or cultural power, it will go wrong. And that's a typical indicator of when empires go down. They get too big. They get impossible to manage, overextended, as you say. They lose legitimacy in the eyes of others. They militarize themselves to death, and they don't adapt to the changing world around them. They think they can bully, like the paternalistic old man who's on his deathbed, can bully the rest of the world. Now, China is a wonderful example of the opposite way of thinking. Defensive thinking, apart from the nuclear weapons. Defensive thinking in the sense we have a right to rise and have a system that is not the same as the West. And that is, of course, in contrast to Russia, a much larger, if you will, challenge to the Western world or the US-dominated imperialist system, that there's somebody who has invested in social economic development, uplifted 700 million people while you can't repair your infrastructure in Washington. I mean, this is just an indicator that things are falling apart. And I'm saying it, although smiling, because it's so obvious what was happening. I predicted this 40 years ago. I said, when the Soviet Union falls, its brother in the West will fall unless it does something else, such as closing down NATO and creating common security in Europe. I wrote that in 1981. And I don't understand why people can't see that those changes in the big world is now for us to adapt to instead of trying to control, because the West is not what it was in the 60s or 70s.
Absolutely. Well, not to be too philosophical about it, but all the great powers, be it Russia or China, had that period of great humiliation. China had a century of humiliation. We, the Russians, also ate our humble pie, very bitter one, back in the early 1990s. And maybe it's time for the United States to do the same. But the thing that concerns me is the, again, the militarization aspect of it, because it seems that the United States is not going to go without a fight. And it's prepared to set up the flames all over the world to do what? Because, I mean, as you mentioned, the system is running out of steam. It's not sustainable, not only in moral terms, but in practical terms. Nobody wants to be within that system anymore, even the American closest allies. What do you think these people are actually trying to achieve, the decision makers in Washington? What are they after? Because no matter how you look at that, it's not possible in practical terms, not in ethical ones, but in practical ones.
I think it's very much a matter of groupthink inside a box. They don't understand the world anymore. And of course, groupthink is about expelling all impressions, views, etc., that could challenge those you have of yourself. And that, of course, as you are hinting, can get very dangerous at some point, because the group of decision makers in NATO and Washington, Brussels and Washington, are of the belief that we cannot make mistakes. And we have made no mistakes. And you're right that more and more of the rest of the world is turning away from the West. The best everybody in the world can do is to walk on two legs, if you ask me. Keep a friendly relationship with the US, but keep it at bay. Don't antagonize it. Don't attack it. Don't do things. Just help it go down with grace. And then work with all the others. I mean, if you can't shape a foreign policy in Europe, which walks on two legs, an EU, NATO, US leg, and the rest of the world leg. It's intellectually not deserving to survive as a system, in my view. But what I argue these days is that we live in a kakistocracy. And a kakistocracy means a government by the least able and the least good people. It's simply people who don't read books, people who do not have advices, people who do not ask for any consultancy from people who disagree with them so they could learn something new. That's why you have censorship in the Western world. That's why people like I, totally marginalized, never used by the Western media, which I was 20 or 30 years ago. So there's only one narrative also, and that's the most dangerous thing, not only for the world that could lead to nuclear weapons being used, we know that, but it's very dangerous for the West itself. Everything the United States, in my view, does at the moment, I'm saying it with sadness because I've never been anti-American, is self-destructive. The United States is getting weaker. You just look at, you know, Kirin 9000, the chip in the Huawei telephone. The Americans thought that they could prevent China from inventing something new in that field. And now they surpass the United States, and they do this time and again.
Yeah, everybody on this planet has the right to be themselves, including nations. And
exactly.
If you define, if you see the threat to your existence, if you characterize it as somebody else's right to development, then it's a lost cause, because it's actually also a very totalitarian claim, if you ask me. Now, can we shift gears a little bit? Because you've written something very interesting that I want to argue with. You suggested that the world must do away with the concept of realpolitik, because in your view, it's anything but realistic. And it's an interesting proposition, to me at least, because I think what we have in Ukraine is the clash between a manufactured perception advanced by the West, we talked about that, and a battle-hardened reality pursued by Russia. And it would seem to me that if more countries were to adopt realpolitik approach like Russia does, for example, the world would be a safer place. Don't you think like that?
Well, of course, Oksana, the whole thing has to do with how we define realpolitik. I do it in a more, let's say, theoretical academic way. It is seeing the world as nation states. It's national security over common security, regional security, and global security. It is maximizing one's own interests, in some cases, to the detriment of others. It is a priority to military means when things get tough, you know. Those kinds of things, in my view, and that's how I define it roughly without a long explanation, is something that has to go. And realpolitik has brought us where we are now. And that is the most dangerous situation since 1945. That's the ways of thinking. For instance, you know, you have Western and I would say Russian and Chinese leaders who at the moment do not think necessarily in the terms first of nonviolent conflict resolution and common security.
Well,
let's argue about that,
because as you know, when the Soviet Union collapsed, Russia and China had over, I think, 8,000 territorial disputes. And these two countries painstakingly negotiated all of them to the point
very
that
true.
We now
very
have
true.
The longest border with China, and we can afford to pull troops from that border and ship
very
them
true.
To the West when we are dealing with Ukraine, because there's a trusted relationship, a win-win relationship, and the recognition by both countries that in the longer term, it's far more beneficial for them to, you know, have that container of a relationship than argue over minuscule things. What do you think stands in the way of the United States or the West adopting the same approach that, sure, you put your interests first, but at least you can have the foresight, understanding that if you put your adversary down, then it will come back to hurt you?
Sure. What I mean to say is that civilian conflict resolution, mediation, reconciliation, forgiveness, UN-ordered peacekeeping, strong UN compared with national organizations and military, are weaker. That's why I say realpolitik is not the right way to go. If you ask me what we need to do in this world, and I've written a huge article about the future peace system of the world in China investment, the only ones who are interested in global peace thinking today really are the Chinese, is that we reduce violence everywhere. Violence against nature, violence against each other, violence against cultures, men's violence against women, and the violence between actors, and address, as I said in the beginning, what stands between us, because there will always be conflicts in any system, be it a marriage, a school, a workplace, an international system. Conflicts are lovely. We should accept and celebrate our differences, because that makes the world rich. And then we should climb down from the trees and know how to use toolboxes where there's something else but a hammer in it. You see what I mean? It's this whole thing that makes me believe that realpolitik is dangerous for us all. And I don't know a country that has a ministry of peace. I don't know anybody who trains their diplomats in knowing what peace and conflict resolution is. But we have tons of military expertise, we have legal expertise, and we have politicians who want more weapons than less weapons. You can take the whole parliament in Denmark and Sweden, all the parties from east to left, from left to right, are for arming Ukraine. Now, this is a realpolitik thinking that I think must go. Nobody talks about finding a negotiated solution on the, by the way, not Ukraine-Russia conflict, but the NATO-Russia conflict that plays out in Ukraine, because that's what it is. I think that the goal for all humanity to survive is to reduce violence, condemn violence, and do something else. And that's fully possible. I tell you, there's a huge toolbox for that. There are institutes around the world which deals with peace and disarmament and civilized conflict resolution instead of beating each other.
Absolutely. Can I ask you something about the conflicts? You spoke very passionately about it, and I happen to study psychology on the side, including couple counseling. And indeed, within couple counseling, it's considered that conflict is the only way of developing. You know, you address your disagreements, you voice your disagreements honestly, you address them by bringing them to the conflict or negotiating table. But there is one very important clause to a conflict is that both sides consider themselves to be equal. That means that you have your truth, I have my truth, and we are not seeing each other as, you know, like a shining city on a hill, disparting wisdom to, you know, the rest of the people living somewhere down the valley. Do you think the West will ever, on a moral, ethical, psychological, philosophical level, accept that it's on par with everybody else, that everybody else, Russians, Chinese, Latin Americans, Africans, whatever, we are all people and we are entitled to our own vision of the world and peace and humanity just as much as the people in the West are?
Wonderful question again, thank you. Yes, I believe that's possible. I think the West, if you mean the US NATO system, will have to go. It will go when the empire has crumbled or declined or become less important, and there will be rethinking. The West is good enough and intelligent and smart and cultured enough to rethink its own policies. But at the moment, you have somebody who runs this and say, don't think, just go kill. As long as you have those leaders, there is not much hope. But in my view, that's only going to take a few more years. What you and I don't know sitting here talking about it is whether the Western empire, the US empire, NATO will go down with a bang or with a whimper. But what I think is possible, that there's one reason that I would side with your skepticism, that is the Christianity as a core value, and that's both your country and our country over here. We are two Western systems compared with, you know, the Western system and China, which is completely different. These two brothers, if you will, Marx and Adam Smith, to caricature it a bit, is built on the idea of mission. We want to make somebody else a little bit like us, or if they don't do it, you know, with the Bible, we come with a sword. That's not in Buddhism or Confucianism or the other isms. So if we could learn from others like they have learned from us, a humanities dialogue about how to create unity and diversity and solve conflicts with much less violence, make you know, a real Nobel Peace Prize that rewards those who built down their armies, something like inviting the confidence building measure. I take a little step and invite you to take a little step downwards also from the high levels of weapons and violence. Of course we can do it. Why would I spend 50 years of my life understanding these things if I didn't believe that peace is possible? It is eminently possible, whereas what we do now is not possible in the long run.
Well, Mr. Oberg, our time is up. Thank you very much for being with us today.
My great pleasure, Roxana. Thanks a lot.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.